Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
Ed was just having a little sing of "We Don't Need No Education."
Oh, that was a different version. You did it as a sort of kind of slightly more country and western version.
Do you think that's what it was?
I think that's what I like about your musical performances. You always put your own stamp on, you know.
I can't help it. It's just who I am artistically.
Exactly.
I have a lot of integrity.
Exactly.
But the reason Ed was singing that song is we are talking education this week, and I thought we could start by asking you about your school days.
Oh.
So what was your primary school?
My first primary school was Featherbank Mount in Leeds, because I was started in Leeds, and we had a teacher called Mrs. Wilkinson who was kind of scary biscuits, really.
In what way was she scary biscuits? That's that phrase again.
She was just old and scary biscuits, really.
So what age were you when you moved from Leeds to London?
7. Well, then I went to school in America for a year because my father was teaching in America. So I went to the same time. My claim to fame, I went to the same elementary school at almost exactly the same time as Matt Damon.
No!
Yes!
So what if he...
I mean, you know, I could have been born. That's basically it. I could have been Jason Bourne.
Have you ever sort of like looked into?
I've met Matt Damon once, and we talked about that we both went to this elementary school. We remembered teachers who had been there. It was almost exactly the same time.
So then you moved from there to London.
Yeah.
And how was fitting in? Because everybody else had been going to school together
for a
few years.
Actually, it was primary school. It was a nice primary school.
And secondary school?
Haverstock Comprehensive. You know, is the adjustment from primary to secondary school is a big adjustment, but you know, I enjoyed aspects of it.
Are you familiar with the film The Breakfast Club?
Is that Keanu Reeves or something?
It's not. It's Emilio Estevez.
Oh, yeah.
But you've got the archetypal high school students, and you've got the goth, and there's the prom queen,
nerd.
And there's the rebel, and then there's the nerd.
Nerd.
And then
nerd.
There's the bad boy.
Nerd.
I mean, I'm just
bad boy.
Wondering
I'm the bad
which
boy.
One of those
nerd.
You
were. Nerd. Nerd. And what were you then? What were you, sort of smart ass?
I mean, I think we can all see that I was the cool rebel kid in a leather jacket.
Yeah, yeah, right.
The outsider.
Were you? What were
I
you?
Was the nerd as well. Of course, I was.
Yeah.
And who was your favourite teacher at secondary school?
They were all real lefties. It was 1980s in London, so they were all like massive lefties.
Yeah.
I remember. I remember in one of my early French classes, my French teacher, Mr. Holly, saying un bonhomme. And he said, for example, he said, Fidel Castro est un bonhomme. That was a sign of my school. And we'd have sort of lectures in the sort of assemblies about sort of Nicaragua and solidarity. But look, there were joking apart, there were really great, inspiring teachers, maths, physics, English. I'm still in touch with Chris Dunn, who's my English teacher for A-level. And so you know, really, honestly, really, really inspiring teaching.
Mm-hmm.
When you said, what's your favourite teacher? To be fair, actually, across the board, I had like physics, which I've not got no real aptitude for. I managed to get an A, remarkably, in my physics A-level, but I've no sort of natural ability for it. It was just because I had great teaching. A woman called Miriam Rosen taught me.
So you're quite animated. So school days were good days for you?
Yeah, the teaching was great. We haven't really said much about your school days.
I figured out where our music teacher, Mrs. Friends, kept the report paper, and she would let us go into her room and practice music during break times. So I nicked a load of report paper, and I would write my own reports. And then when I'd get the school report, I'd take the staples out. I'd throw away the teacher's reports, which were terrible because I was lagging so far behind, and I'd replace them with my own. But I would try to keep an element of realism. So I'd give myself an A- and say, Jeffrey's very bright, but he could really try a bit harder. And I remember getting in trouble from my parents for reports that I'd written for myself.
How long did you do that for?
A couple of years.
How extraordinary.
It's terrible, isn't it?
That is an extraordinary story.
I'm a very devious person.
Not everybody did that, let me just say.
Why are we talking about this?
Because we're talking about education, and there's so much to talk about in education, but so this is not the only education episode we'll do, but one area to start with, which is what we're talking about this week, is curriculum, the curriculum, and what do kids get taught in schools? And how could it be better? And this is partly prompted by the fact that there's been a real cutting back of creative arts subjects in schools. The BBC did a recent survey showing 9 out of 10 schools had cut back on creative arts subjects. We've got the lowest number taking a creative arts subject at GCSE for a decade. There's research showing we've got 1,700 fewer drama teachers. And I think it goes to a big issue about education in this country, which is it too narrow? Do we test too much? Do we have a system that is still built for an age when people left school at 16, i.e. GCSEs, which were O-levels and CSEs when I was taking them, not when you were, of course, because you're borderline millennial.
Yeah.
But, you know, should we be just having an exam at 18? I mean, there's just a huge number of issues about what people get taught, and whether school's too boring in some ways, whether it's just too rote, and the sort of figure of Michael Gove hovers a little bit over this conversation, I think.
Ooh, that's spooky.
We're going to be talking to James Graham, who is a playwright that some people will have heard of, and a writer. He wrote a quite successful play called This House. He's got a play on in the West End at the moment called Ink about Rupert Murdoch. He's got one called Labour of Love about the Labour Party. He's, really well regarded as one of the best young playwrights around. He comes from Mansfield, and he really cares about what's happening to creative subjects in schools. He's going to be talking about that. Then we're going to be talking to Jez Bennett, who's a head teacher at Elizabeth Woodville School in Northamptonshire. He's also a musician with an MA in software design, so he covers all the bases. And he's going to be talking about something that they're doing, which is they're piloting what they call a National Baccalaureate for England, which is a broader curriculum. And then we're going to be talking to Madeline Holt, an education campaigner and a co-founder of an organisation called Rescue Our Schools.
And coming in to pitch ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we are joined by comedian Alice Fraser, who is not only very funny, but her training is in the law.
Good.
Yeah. What about our reasons to be cheerful then?
What's yours?
My reason to be cheerful is I managed to spread some fake news.
Yes.
So I was in on my own the other night, and I remembered that I'd seen that picture of the Spice Girls.
Yes.
Around Jerry Halliwell's house. So I thought, I'm just going to start some fake news and see how far it gets. So I did a tweet saying, a friend of mine who works in television tells me that the Spice Girls reunion project is a big talent TV show, and each Spice Girl is going to pick her own replacement. So in other words, they're finding a next generation of baby gingers.
It's quite
sporty.
A good idea.
Yeah. So I tweeted this as if it was a fact, and I've spent the whole week fending off tweets and messages from Spice Girls fans who are horrified by the idea. And it's not happening as far as I know. I just made it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think to mount a defense of you for a minute compared to sort of Donald Trump's lies, I mean, yeah. I think you're still in the sort of Vauxhall Conference. You know what I mean? I think in a positive sense.
You've got to start somewhere though, don't you?
Well, no, but I mean, I don't think you're yet a sort of threat to world stability.
Okay.
Or sort of, nuclear war.
Yeah, okay. Well, you just give me some time. You watch me go. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, my reason to be cheerful is that I've booked tickets to go to America.
We're going to America?
No, me and George Ezra. No, me and my children are going to America for Easter.
Great.
Because I have always wanted to take them to see the Boston Red Sox.
the baseball team I support. And I've started to induct them into baseball. And so the season begins around Easter, so we're going. And I prompted...
Do you get the impression they're going along with the baseball thing willingly? Are they into it? Is it something being foisted upon them?
Well, I showed them one, the most famous Boston Red Sox game in history, 2004, when they came back against the New York Yankees, blah, blah, blah. And they were quite interested. And then I tried to show the sort of next game the next night, and they got a bit bored.
Softly.
It wasn't softly enough. So I think they're quite interested, but you know, we're gonna spend some time in New York, which should be fun.
So envious.
And Chicago.
Aha. So you could pop around and see my mother-in-law.
Exactly.
You could go for a sandwich at my brother-in-law's food
fat
truck,
Shallot.
The Fat Shallot.
Yeah, and that'll be quite fun boys trip.
Will you bring me something back?
Like a sandwich.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
I'm delighted to say that we're now joined by James Graham, a very successful young playwright who's got two shows in the West End at the moment, Ink about Rupert Murdoch and Labour of Love, a play about the Labour Party. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit, first of all, about your background, where you went to school and how you first got interested in theatre and the arts.
I didn't really come from a particularly theatrical family. My mum worked in a school and a warehouse, and my dad worked for the council. But I was just really lucky. I went to a comprehensive school, a state school in Mansfield, quite a huge one, an area that was suffering from post-industrial decline. There was lots of poverty. But for whatever reason, there was a philosophy in the school, from the headmaster down to the teachers, that the arts, and in particular drama, should be accessible, not just as a treat, but actually as a way of helping with some of the social and emotional problems in the community by getting kids on stage, telling stories, introducing them to texts, new and classics. I know for absolutely certain, without the commitment from the school and the passion of my drama teacher in particular, Mr. Humphrey, who introduced me to all these bits of new British writing and international writing, that I wouldn't be a playwright. I wouldn't be talking to you now. I wouldn't have those shows on in the West End and be able to bring my perspective from my community to a wider audience. So yeah, I was really lucky.
So what was the first play or theatre thing that you were involved in at school?
Oh God, I did loads of really bad musicals where I couldn't sing, for a start. I was actually in Oliver and I couldn't even sing, so someone else had to sing for me. But even the experience of the collective experience of getting together with your peers and interrogating a story, and all that you have to do when you do that in terms of, you know, unpacking your empathy towards a certain character and understanding a character's motivations, walking in the shoes of as a character that with a very different experience from yours, being introduced to worlds and environments in all sorts of plays and shows and musicals that you wouldn't normally have access to. I just think it's the best way to expand your perspective and your horizon and introduce you to different cultures and communities and people suffering and working under different conditions.
You've recently said that the main issue facing the sector is arts education, and that drama is disappearing by stealth in state schools. Could you explain that and tell us about the scale of the problem?
For me, it snuck up quite quickly and quite quietly. But obviously, I think for those working in schools, I've got a lot of friends around the country who work in different disciplines within state schools. They've noticed it for a while. And the first I heard about it anecdotally, I was with some friends who are PE teachers up in Sheffield. And they just mentioned to me that drama had accidentally gone. And I was like, what do you mean? How has it gone? And they told me that a lot of their drama school teachers in the past couple of years, when they've retired, they've just not been replaced. And so I started investigating this further with other drama teachers. And yes, resources are dwindling. The amount of time that's being allocated to these subjects are dwindling. And so, you know, we have now the statistics. We know from various different reports that 9 out of 10 schools have had to cut back on the amounts of art they're teaching. We've lost 1,700 drama school teachers since 2010. I think there's about a quarter less uptake in state schools for A-level arts. And I suppose what really frightens me is that we already had a mobility problem in the sector, in the art, that too much of our acting on screen, as you will have seen, too much of the people filming, directing, working in theatre, and in particular writing, was coming from an ever narrower band of society. And that's before these cuts to state education began. And state education was always the equalizer. It was always, no matter what your background, you know, you got at least a moderate introduction into drama, into plays. So if that's disappearing, I think we're not even going to know the impact of that for another decade, when suddenly all of our national narratives and our stories are being diminished.
And do you get the impression it's financial to do with cuts made in education, or do you get the impression it's ideological in terms of what goes into the curriculum?
I mean, it's probably both, but we know that it is. I mean, we know it is philosophical for a start, because the new qualification, the EBAC, doesn't recognise the importance of arts in terms of its measurement of schools. And, you know, obviously, the EBAC was introduced for a good reason. We all understand what that was. There was diminishing standards in terms of literacy and mathematics, and it was right that be tackled. But I think it's fundamentally short-term thinking and false thinking to think that the health of your school can stay strong and survive if you're giving in no way, shape or form any creative or artistic means of expression to your kids, even if they don't want to become like me, a writer or an actor, or if they don't want to direct at movies. It's just what that process does be outside of academia. The mental and emotional health that comes from these kind of subjects. And this is all the problem with this level of argument, is it always sounds quite airy fairy and hard to prove. It's hard to measure. But we just know that if you're denying this type of communication, this type of access to anything, music, painting, photography, that there's a part of people you're shutting down. And we need that, whether we're going to be financiers or bankers or politicians or anything. We need that part of ourselves to be nurtured.
And there's a great irony to this, isn't there? Because it's not like the private schools are cutting back on these things. I mean, you know what I mean? It's not like the private schools are all saying, oh, well, look, you know, we don't want people to be actors. We don't want people to do creative arts subjects. None of these things matter.
No, that's exactly right. So if they can see the value and the worth in making sure that the future captains of industry or the future business leaders do Shakespeare, because it's going to be viable to their career and to the school's reputation, then hello, yeah, exactly. We should be waking up to this. You've identified what I also fear, which is that there's a two-tier system here now, with of course, as school plays get cut back in state schools and trips to the theatre get cut back and get squeezed. Meanwhile, on the other side of the tracks, they're just investing in them, and they have the resource and the facilities. So, you know, in the plays in the West End in the future, are they all going to be from the perspective of people who are lucky enough to have that private education, which would be devastating?
Now, we've got a thing called the Jeffocracy, which is slightly fear-inducing, which is Jeff ruling the country.
I think it's utopian. Ed thinks it's dystopian.
Yeah, exactly. If in the Jeffocracy you were to be made the culture secretary, or the culture secretary and the education secretary, what would you do?
Well, immediately make sure that the arts were recognised in the EBAC. There's absolutely no reason why that shouldn't be the case. I don't even think it's financial. I think it's purely philosophical. So they should immediately take into account at least one arts subject, whatever it is, and have that as a standard of measurement for how successful the school is teaching its kids. And then, you know, again, it's a hard and unpopular argument to make often in the times of austerity, but we know that it's not subsidy when you spend money on the arts. It's an investment. For every £1 you spend investing in the arts, you get £5 back to the treasury. I spent a lot of time in Hull this year, the city of culture, and the economic benefits of art has been indisputable on jobs and community. So I think you probably just need to throw a bit of money from education into making sure kids can put on school plays, can go to the theatre, can make their own work. And even if you don't buy the airy fairy stuff about how important it is to the emotional health of the country, it's baffling to me, as it's one of the last things we do really well in this country. Without our military and without our sports teams, we're still the guys out there who are touring work around the world, who are winning the Oscars, whose work is read in schools across the world. It's, you know, people want to listen to our stories, and it's one of the last megaphones that we have as a community. And I don't know why the short-term thinking is that that's going to get quieter and quieter. It makes no sense.
And to be clear about this, Inc. and This House and Labour of Love and all of the things that you've done, they wouldn't be there if it hadn't been for the education you had and for your teacher, Mr. Humphrey, and his philosophy?
No, 100% absolutely not. And it's an easy thing to say, hard to prove, but no, I know it. If I hadn't been introduced to writing that excited me, to plays, to films, to movies, to, if he hadn't have unlocked that part of me that could create and imagine, then definitely I wouldn't be here, and those plays wouldn't be here.
James, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So we're joined now by Jez Bennett, who's the head teacher at Elizabeth Woodville School in Northamptonshire. Jez, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Tell us to begin with, since our focus is on the curriculum and creativity, what you think the current state of play is in our school system around the curriculum that we're teaching our kids, whether creativity is getting a proper look in, and what needs doing.
I think we're at quite a concerning moment. We've got quite a debate going on about whether our curriculum should be focused on the core, you know, the English, the maths, the science, and to what extent we should make other elements, including the arts and technology, compulsory or optional. And we're finding increasingly that those areas are being squeezed, and they're mainly being squeezed for two reasons. The BBC did a survey a couple of weeks ago about this, and they found that the financial constraints on schools alongside the accountability pressures are squeezing to a large extent arts out of the curriculum, particularly at Key Stage 4, so sort of GCSE level. We know that the data tells us that there are fewer and fewer students taking, you know, for example, art and drama and music GCSEs. The figure's sort of up to 25% in drama since about 2010. And the flip side is we've seen an increase in subjects like history and geography, which have been increasingly favoured, I suppose, by various government initiatives and accountability measures. And I'm just really concerned as a, you know, from a music background, I did music at university, I still sing, and I see that having a really adverse impact in school, particularly at a time when we are encouraging social mobility, aren't we? And we want all students to have an equal opportunity, a comprehensive, broad education. And I think those very students that need that more than others are going to suffer the most from the various pressures that we find ourselves faced with.
And presumably one of the points here is that this isn't just bad because people aren't doing the creative subjects, which, you know, have merit in themselves, but this also kind of has an impact on their on people's general engagement with education. Is that right?
That's true. I mean, we know that the arts are important for all sorts of reasons. You know, lots and lots of skills that we learn by taking art subjects, including sort of communication and expression and self-control and confidence, all those kind of things. What's interesting is when I've talked to my students about why the arts are important to them, particularly those that are taking, say, GCSEs, they all, without exception, have talked about mental health. They've all talked about the way the arts give them something that they really enjoy, that it, and they don't use the word easier, but something that they can connect with more readily, if you like. It's almost that little respite in the curriculum. I don't think those subjects are easy at all, but those students have particular strengths and particular ways of learning that the arts provide for them and help them. And they've all identified the stresses and pressures that young people are feeling under. I don't know if you read the all-party parliamentary group report into creative health and creative arts and health that came out, I think, last year. But there's a really strong connection, isn't there, between the arts and well-being. And I'm concerned about that element too.
And in terms of your school, you're one of the pilot areas for something called the National Baccalaureate for England. Can you tell us what that is, how it came about, and whether it addresses some of these concerns?
Yeah, so the National Baccalaureate really came a number of years ago in response to the government's e-baccalaureate initiative, which was the e-bac is a performance measure. It's a way of measuring a certain set of GCSE subjects, and it doesn't really tell us anything we didn't know already. It's not a qualification. Nobody gets a certificate in the e-bac. It's just a way of measuring a specific core curriculum for schools. But we feel that that's not enough. We feel that a true baccalaureate gives recognition for the students' wider achievement. So it's a universal framework giving sort of recognition to the full range of their achievements and their experiences, the qualities that children develop alongside the qualifications. Qualifications are important, but so too are the qualities they develop in their time at school. So group of schools, group of professionals from education sector have got together, and there's general consensus that we want our children to have a rounded whole education, that we want them to develop all sorts of skills, but also their qualities. What is very difficult, of course, is saying that this is the way you should do that. So we're a pilot school for the National Baccalaureate, and that's a trust that's been set up to promote this. And essentially, at this stage, we're just devising what it might look like. So we have our way of doing it. We have a personal development programme that all of our sixth formers are involved with, and that recognises, you know, all sorts of different things, from leadership to physical activity to community involvement, work experience. And they're able to sort of collect all that evidence together and get some recognition for it. We've got other schools around the country doing similar things, and we're coming together and saying, well, this works, this doesn't work, and it's very much in its pilot phase at the moment.
How would your National Baccalaureate be different from the EBAC, just to sort of crunch this down for a second?
The EBAC basically says you've achieved a level 4 or 5 in these 5 subjects at GCSE, and that's it.
And that's English, maths,
Science, language, a language science. And a humanities, geography or history, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And yours?
So to get at the moment, we're looking at level 3. So that's the sort of A-level equivalent. You could do any core learning in that. It's a universal award. So it could be that you're doing a technical qualification or a vocational qualification, as long as it's got a certain weight and breadth. Plus, you've also done some project work. You've done an independent study. Plus, you've done a personal development program, including some of those areas, creative arts, community involvement. And if you qualify for all of those, areas, you'd get a new award. It really is it's a wrapper award, much more in keeping with the kind of award you get with the International Baccalaureate, and they've been involved with us in developing
that. That happens in the rest of Europe. That's the sort of much broader set of education and exams that people do up to the age of 18, basically. Yeah,
International Baccalaureate. That's right. And lots of countries around the world use that International Baccalaureate qualification. So ours is not identical, but it's a much more rounded, full picture of a whole child's achievement.
And I know it's just a pilot at the moment, but what have your learnings been so far? What works, what doesn't work?
Well, what's been really interesting is that students, and when we've asked students about what they've learned through this, they've said, it's just increased my confidence. It's increased my ability to go on interview, my work, my employment skills. I never thought I would want to study. So, for example, we make them study something in great depth, the subject of their choice. It might be, you know, the rate of coronary disease in the village, or it might be one person's done looking at the relationship between spending and success in German football leagues. So a subject of their choice, and they've really gone into great depth, and a lot of them have been quite resistant, but by doing that, the skills and qualities they've developed, they're saying, are really, really helpful for the next stage, whether it be university or employment.
So they pick these topics and then sort of go deep. And of course, like any topic, you dig deep enough into it, it touches on all these other subjects. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's right. They get coaching, they get tutorials through staff. Universities really like that style of learning. We're using one called the Extended Project Qualification, which has been around for a few years, but it's very well respected because it gives students the ability to talk in great depth and show that they're different. They've studied something, they've used some of those skills they might need later on in life, in project development, for example, and it gives them an edge. And in a time of great competition and challenges in the employment sector, that's really, really helpful for them. So they've been really, really positive, and also giving something back to their community. So all of our students, they might be hosting a tea party for the Queen's last birthday, for example, and older people from the village come and they've set that up, done it all themselves. They've developed leadership skills. They've also developed an understanding of where that particular generation are. So really, really beneficial for them, lots of different reasons.
And Jez, let's go through some of the other problems. Do we test our kids too much in Britain? I mean, one thing that, we still have GCSEs at the age of 16, then we have A levels at the age of 18. That's kind of like a spatchcock of old system when kids used to leave school at 16. When I was taking exams. It was O-levels and CSEs with A-levels. I mean, does that make sense? Should we be narrowing? Should we be having fewer tests?
We've certainly over-test. And there aren't many countries in the world that test as much as we do. We really stand alone in that respect. Assessment, of course, is important, but so is trust in the education sector, in the professionals to know where children are. We have had previously links, for example, with schools in Sweden. And, of course, there are national exams in Sweden, but they're much, much more narrow. There are only a couple of subjects at the age of 16, and most of the testing is done at 18. We want our children to continue in education. We have to continue in some kind of education to 18. So I think that exams at 16, they're losing their currency for me. And I think in the long term, that's probably where we should go. We should look to remove those or some of those and put more trust rather than less, which is what we've been doing, in the education profession to really promote and understand where children are. Clearly, there are reasons why that change has happened. There are reasons why we've got new GCSEs at the moment, because politically, we're not sure that schools have been doing perhaps the right thing by their students all the time. But longer term, it's got to be the way forward for me.
And what about the content of what we're teaching our kids? I don't just mean the sort of subjects, but I mean, are we teaching them, and you've hinted at this already, are we teaching them for the sort of 21st century world or the 19th century world? I somehow worry that some of the content of what we do can feel like it won't really prepare them for the world they're entering into. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And we've got a model, haven't we, of education that's very Victorian in its content. If you look at the curriculum from about 1905 or 6 to compare it to now, there's very, very little different. I think the difference is today we teach technology, and in about 1905 they were teaching housewifery. But everything else is pretty much the same, and that can't be right, can it? Now it's true, isn't it, that the subjects that we have are hooks to hang the learning on. All of the learning that we need to be active citizens and successful in later life, we can hang them on a geography hook or a history hook or whatever it is, or a technology hook. But to a certain extent, it doesn't matter what the hooks are. And I think that we need to do some serious thinking about how we, the constraints that we've placed on the curriculum by saying that it has to look like this. So, for example, we had a group of Chinese teachers come to visit us last term, and they were coming to look at drama. And they were coming to look at careers education because they've recognised that, you know, they're not two areas they particularly do in China. This was sort of Shanghai district. You know, Shanghai, one of the areas that nationally we've been looking to for the quality of their English, of quality of their maths and their science curriculum. Absolutely right that we learn from them. But they're coming to learn from us from the creative curriculum. They're coming to learn from us the way we prepare children for the future working life. And that dialogue is really important. And we shouldn't narrow ourselves, constrain ourselves to the kind of curriculum we might have been offering 100 years ago, which I think is really still where we are. We often have this debate, don't we, between which is more important, knowledge or skills. And I remember Michael Gove actually talking, our friend Michael Gove talking about learning a musical instrument. Which do you learn first? He said you learn your scales first and then you learn to play your pieces. It's a bit like saying I learn my words and my grammar before I learn to speak. And it's ridiculous. I don't know whether Michael Gove's played an instrument, but you know, as a musician, of course the scales are important. But you do that alongside the enjoyment, the pleasure of just playing, as you do with language. You learn to speak, and you learn your grammar and your vocabulary as you go along. Knowledge and skills are both clearly important, and we do them together, alongside developing the attitudes and the attributes that mean we can be successful in the future.
So, Jez, we've got this thing on our podcast called the Jeffocracy, which is basically Jeff becoming the ruler of the country, if not the world.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not sure. The jury's out on that question. But if we were to,
I'll have the jury slung into jail.
If we were to make you the education secretary in the Jeffocracy, what would you do?
I'll give you two things I would do. I would abolish Ofsted. And I would champion the arts. And the reason for abolishing Ofsted is not because I don't think we should have accountability. We're a public sector. It's right that we have accountability, that we have an inspector of some description. But I think Ofsted is so tainted in the eyes of the education sector. It's a damaged brand, and we really need to be careful about the way we measure what good schools. Can I give you a little example? Who's the best English batsman? How are you going to measure that? Well, you might measure it by average number of runs scored. You might measure it by the difficulty of getting him out. You might measure it by strike rate. You might measure it by the opposition he was playing. There is no one answer to that. Any kind of measurement like that is complex, and schools are even more complex than that. What we have is a generation of school leaders who have been so pressured by Ofsted, or they fit not by Ofsted, but they feel the pressure of Ofsted. They fear the accountability, that it changes their behaviours all the time. And whenever you go into a school, a room of head teachers, often there'll be conversations about, are you expecting Ofsted this week or that week? I don't know if you remember the Fawlty Towers episode where the hotel inspector turns up. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
And Basil spends the whole time buttering up the wrong guy. And you wonder if we're doing the things that we do in school for Ofsted, or because, you know what, we genuinely believe they're the right things to do. We should worry less about Ofsted. It's right that we have an inspection and accountability, but it needs to be intelligent. And we should do the things that we believe in because they're important. So that's the first thing I would do. Second thing I would do, I'd just say, let's do more arts. Let's value all the things that the arts teach us.
And that's an easy sell to people like me and Ed, but there's a type of person, I guess, who's more conservatively minded and really values lists of kings and queens.
If you do more of one thing, you've got to do less of something else. And it's a debate, isn't it? But at the moment, the arts have been totally squeezed out of that debate. In fact, we haven't really had it. You know, remember the 2012 Olympics? You know, the thing that we remember most for a lot of people, apart from the sport, would be that opening ceremony. It was a celebration, wasn't it, of British literature and theatre and music and dance and technology. And if we were to host such an event again, do you think our ability to produce a similar spectacle would be because of our education system or in spite of our education system? And I feel that's a challenge to us, isn't it, to think about what kind of education system do we want that really celebrates and develops those areas in addition, perhaps, to those other subjects.
That's great. Jez, thank you so much for joining us. It's really, really inspiring. I'm going to come and do another A-level with you, and Jeff's going to come too.
You're welcome. Come and do music.
Yeah, I want to do a baccalaureate.
Oh, a baccalaureate. Yeah, definitely.
Nice to speak to you.
So listening to that with us is Madeline Holt, education campaigner and co-founder of Rescue Our Schools. Madeline, hello.
Hi.
Can you tell us about Rescue Our Schools? What is it? What's your involvement?
Yeah, sure. I set it up with some other parents in 2016, and the cue for it was the announcement from the government that they wanted to force all schools to academise. So that was the sort of straw that broke the camel's back as far as we were concerned. But we were bothered by it a lot more, really. We felt the schools were becoming exam factories, they were becoming joyless, and that in a way lots of politicians were talking about how children should be punished in them almost, that there shouldn't be any kind of interest from them or any ownership of their own learning. And we were really bothered about the mental health consequences as well, with all sorts of reports coming out all the time saying that children and young people were starting to say how stressed they were becoming by the system. And so we wanted to do something. We felt that parents needed a bit more of a voice. So we set up Rescue Our Schools, which has become a sort of Facebook page and a chance for us to speak publicly and submit evidence to inquiries and the like. And what we're doing really is trying to get more informed, inform more parents about what we think is going wrong, why it's going wrong, how many of the reforms that have been imposed on schools recently have been done so without proper evidence. And most importantly for me, I think we need to know about the alternatives. And we really need to get educated about schools that are doing it differently. And there are plenty of examples, both in England, actually, and particularly abroad. And we're becoming kind of outliers in going in a really different direction.
Can I just ask a very basic question, which is our curriculum fit for purpose? And if it isn't, in what way isn't it?
My answer would be no, it's not. And that's both primary and secondary. And just picking up on what Jez said, I would argue that there's two reasons why it's not fit for purpose. The first is that it's too narrow. And the second is the reason it's so narrow is because the accountability measures that are in place are just looking at the very few subjects. You know, for example, in primary, they're just looking at maths and English, and they're using the scores in maths and English now to judge schools. So that's the sort of toxic link. If you broke that link so that the scores that that schools were coming up with were not used to say this school's a good school, this school's an outstanding school, this school, you know, needs to be academised or whatever, or always requires improvement and so on, then you take a lot of the pressure away from teachers to teach the test.
So the evolution of this, just for our listeners, is Michael Gove introduces the EBAC in 2014. That's got a focus on sort of five so-called key subjects. Even with the new measure, the thing called Progress 8 in the jargon, there's extra weight put on English, maths, foreign language, humanities, science. And that's, so it's not a coincidence that we've seen this decline in creative arts subjects, drama, art subjects, that whole range of subjects. That's the basic story about what's going on, whatever we think of it. That's the story of what's going on. Is that right?
That's the story in secondary. But there's another story in primary where Michael Gove decided to make SATs a lot harder. So he felt that the way that we needed to kind of move on internationally and get onto a level pegging with other countries that are doing well in these things called PISA tests was to make all exams a hell of a lot harder. So he did it in SATs, and he did it also in GCSEs and in A-levels. But the problem with that is there's absolutely no evidence that if you make an exam harder, students developmentally will catch up. And so what you got with the SATs and what you're starting to see now with some GCSEs is lots and lots of kids are failing. And when the SATs were first introduced, nearly half of all kids were told they were not secondary school ready, which I just think is criminal. It destroys their confidence as learners at the age of just 10 or 11.
And tell us about the experience of Britain compared to other countries. I mean, are we an outlier? In what way are we an outlier?
We're an outlier in the way that, as Jez says, that we are testing so much. We're doing even more testing than the States, and that is saying something. And we are an outlier in having such a punitive system in terms of linking those test scores to the way schools are judged. And we're now starting to see this pressure to teach in a certain way. So not just the narrow subjects, you know, what perceived as being the hard subjects, which I don't personally think is true, but we are hearing a lot of stuff from the current government, from the schools minister, Nick Gibb, about how he doesn't like project-based learning. He's very keen on something called teacher-led instruction, which is about kind of much more chalk and talk, teachers being at the front of the class and saying, you know, here's a load of facts and you've got to absorb them and remember them. There's been a huge reduction in the amount of coursework at GCSE. So now it's basically all exams, probably a bit like when we were at school. So there's these multiple pressures which actually mean that we are kind of going back in time. And if you look at the international picture, even as Jez said, in areas like China, South Korea, Singapore, these countries are thinking really hard now about how they can ensure that their children are not robots, because they're saying, do you know what? The economy is going to be dominated by robots in certain areas. And so we need to pull out the really human skills, such as creative thinking, critical thinking, problem solving, being able to work in a team. And some of these skills have been looked at for a long time in countries like Finland, Alberta and Canada.
Can I ask you about Finland? Because I feel there was a period maybe 3-4 years ago when I'd constantly be reading Finland is the place that knows how to do education. Is that the case? And if so, what are they doing that's so different to everybody else?
Well, for a long time, they've been focusing on a much broader curriculum and using all sorts of different techniques. So project-based learning is one of them. And it's fair to say there isn't a lot of evidence that it necessarily works. But on the other hand, if you do it well, then it can be very successful.
Is there evidence to say it doesn't work, though?
It's a very mixed picture. And I think it's true to say that in the past, perhaps in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of project-based learning, which was a bit woolly.
Right.
And unfortunately, because of that, that's now being used by the sort of more traditional group to say, oh, it's a load of old rubbish. Actually, the schools like School 21, which is a free school out in Stratford in East London, which is doing project-based learning, but it's very intelligently thought through. It's very rigorously assessed. So it's like anything, you can do teacher-led instruction badly. Yeah. It's just how you do it.
And I'm right in thinking also, I don't want to go on a complete Finland diversion here, but that it's a very competitive, teaching is a very competitive profession to get into in Finland. I mean, the ratio of applications to whether you get to, I mean, it's like, it's exalted as the most important profession almost in the country.
It's a very tough apprenticeship. I think you do a 4-year degree, if I'm right. And as you say, it's really respected. It's very well paid. And teachers are trusted. So what you don't have is this kind of climate of distrust that we've had for a number of years now. You know, this is not just something that's developed over the last 7 years or so. Instead, you have a confidence that teachers can do their own assessment. So I'm not saying tests aren't worth it or assessment isn't worth it. Of course it is. It's really, really important. It's how you do it. So they have a lot of time, actually, in the average Finnish day where teachers, when they've stopped doing their teaching, they sit around and they look at students' work. And it's a very individualistic approach. I suppose the conclusion from that is if we want to treat our children as individuals, you have to have a much more individual way of rating how they're doing. And we have a standardised system now, which kind of reduces kids to scores on a kind of production line.
Let me just sort of challenge that slightly. I mean, one of the things that has happened compared to 20 years ago is the transformation in London schools. Okay, that was about investment, the London Challenge and all that, but it was also about recognising that when schools were failing, something had to be done about it. I mean, how do you not throw the baby out with the bathwater in this?
I totally agree. I mean, I don't know about your school, but at my school, there were plenty of kids who fell through the net, and that was not right. And I can think of about 10,
that's right.
Yeah, I can think of about 10 kids in my class who could have gone on to university and didn't. And so there is a social justice dimension to a lot of what has driven this really precise accountability framework. And I get that. And I think that a lot of these initiatives are very well-meaning. And the focus on discipline is really important because I'm sure your classes are the same as my classes. All it takes is one kid to mess around and you definitely can't concentrate. And attendance.
Jeff, for example. I'm sure you didn't mess around, did you?
Just played truant.
All right, okay. At least you weren't disrupting it for everyone else.
Now if you play truant, your school will get downgraded. I mean, there are really tough requirements now in terms of attendance. And I think that's good, basically. There's ways to do it. There's ways of squaring the circle. And if you look at countries that are doing it well, which we don't do enough of, we're really myopic. There's, for example, New Zealand's a really good example. They've just got rid of standardised testing in primary schools with the new Labour government there. But what they've been doing there for a number of years is this thing called national sampling. So they'll pick a random group of kids. They'll come in. These kids will do a test. It's often about much, much deeper skills and also testing knowledge, because I'm not saying knowledge isn't important. But those kids can't prepare for that test. And they'll do it over, you know, a whole load of schools. And then they'll get a really good national picture of how a country's doing in certain areas. And we do that at the moment in primary science. And so I'm part of a group called More Than a Score, which is a sort of coalition of parents groups and academics and mental health professionals. And we're all saying, look, there's loads of different ways of doing it. We're not against assessment. We're in favour of a much more intelligent form of assessment.
And even so-called, and sorry to go into the technicalities, value added, which shows the progress that kids make, children, young people make from entering secondary school into GCSEs or whatever, that doesn't do it for you either.
It's how it's done, because the problem at the moment is you get these flight paths. So, for example, I don't know if you know, but the government's latest wheeze is introducing something called baseline testing of four-year-olds. So if it goes through, four-year-olds within the first half term of their school will be having an iPad test of their literacy and numeracy. And that test score will be used to predict how they do in SATs in year six. So the danger is that those kids, if they do badly, schools will be under huge pressure to show progress. So they'll stick the kids on differentiated tables. So if you do badly in that test, and it's quite possible you will, if you're summer born or you're a boy, or you're from a less privileged background, or you have special needs, or have English as an additional language, all those groups we know do badly in these tests because they've been tried before, then the danger is you'll be put on a lower ability table and you will stay on that, and the expectations of your teachers will be lowered throughout your primary education. And the really scary thing is then those SATs results will be used as they are now to predict how well teachers reckon you're going to do in GCSE, which is part of the whole Progress 8 measure. And I just think it's just not right to put kids on these predetermined paths when there's absolutely no evidence in terms of child development that people develop in a straight line. They don't.
And is part of the issue here what we think education is for? I mean, I can't help feeling that it is that.
It's absolutely that. And what we're trying to do is another thing, another campaigning element, is something else we're trying to get off the ground. We've written a book called Education Forward, which is a whole collection of people. I've written something on alternatives to SATs, as with my kind of Rescue Our Schools, More Than Score hat on. We're trying to argue that with Labour talking about a national education service, which I personally think is a brilliant idea, especially for this current generation of kids who have been so impoverished in terms of their experience, that the time has come for us to sit down and say, what is the point of education? You know, what's it all about? The traditional model has been arguing, you know, it's about trying to encourage economic growth. I don't hold to that argument. I'm actually, you know, don't think that we should be thinking about economic growth. We need to be thinking about sustainability. For me, the question is, how do we make people fulfilled citizens? And what kind of skills are they going to need to cope with an incredibly challenging future? And I think, for me, they'll need deeper skills. They'll need not just doing music and doing drama and all the rest of it, but they'll need to develop critical thinking. The thing, problem solving, there's going to be so many problems around. So those are the sort of things which I think we should have basically an independent national commission to discuss, and we should look at what other countries are doing and try and recalibrate our curriculum and kind of hedge our bets, because we don't know how the future's going to go. And it's all very well saying, oh, we're going to put loads and loads of money into maths and loads of money into coding. Yeah, great. But we should put loads of money into everything else as well, because we just can't predict what our kids are going to have to end up doing.
And if we offered you the same job as Jez, maybe in a sort of partnership, made you the education secretary in the Jeffocracy, what would you do?
I would endorse everything that Jeff says.
Jez, I'm sorry. You do very well in my administration.
I'm sure Jeff agrees with everything Jez
exactly.
says.
You'll be a successful member of his cabinet.
I would really promote this thing called Oracy, which is has been pioneered by School 21 and is now, a lot of people are trying it out. I mean, for example, in Camden, there's a lot of Oracy stuff going on, which is trying to encourage people to become really fluent in terms of communication, which is such a crucial skill in life. You know, you can have fantastic qualifications, but if you can't communicate, what's the point?
They sometimes say that about the public school kids, that they get this sort of confidence and ability to do that you don't get coming through the state.
Well, precisely. I've just made a film about an amazing school called Torriano. There's lots of schools doing it where they are really focusing on the need to be able to, for example, come home from school and tell your parents what you've done that day.
Well, that would be good.
You know, I mean, I actually don't know what my kids get up to a lot of the time. It's probably the
same
with you.
No, I don't either.
And it's really inspiring to hear them talk about it and also learn to listen. So I would encourage that. I would encourage the baccalaureate model, which is based on competency, not this kind of high stakes grading system.
So that's just for those people who don't know, that's getting rid of the GCSE.
I would get rid of GCSEs.
And basically you'd work towards a baccalaureate rather than
18,
the A-level.
Yeah.
The A-levels could be part of it.
Loads of countries don't have an exam at 16. I would get rid of SATs. I would get rid of baseline testing. I would get rid of the multiplication check. I would get rid of the phonics check. We don't need any of this stuff. And it's stressing kids out, even really young kids. I would have a national debate. I mean, what we're trying to do is something called the Big Education Conversation. So really, it's in its infancy, but really develop at grassroots discussions about education, screenings of countries that are doing it differently. There's a film called Most Likely to Succeed, which is about an amazing chain of schools in the States on the West Coast, where kids just make stuff. They have a project, they make, for example, a massive great clock with loads of cogs, and then instead of having, you know, some sort of exam at the end of every term, they have a public exhibition, and people from that community come in and look at it. And loads of high-tech gurus are trying to get their kids into these schools because actually, ironically, they're doing brilliantly in all the kind of conventional tests to get into Stanford and get Yale and all the rest of it. So that's actually the positive, which is if you adopt this much broader model of education, the huge irony is kids do really, really well in all the conventional exams as well.
Okay, Madeline Holt, thank you so much for joining us and giving us all these ideas. And I think she got the job in the Jeffocracy.
I think so.
Particularly after she agrees with
you. Yeah,
it was
between her and Jez. And
well, like, you could give them both the job, maybe.
No, I'm giving it to Madeline, so right, she'll agree with everything I say.
Okay.
Accepted.
So what do you think?
I think there's just such enormous value in these subjects, but persuading people of that can be a hard thing. When I was growing up, nobody's thinking, oh, he'll grow up and be a film director, or he'll...
Was this a arty-farty problem?
Yeah, he'll grow up and be a musician. So when people are thinking about what should be taught in schools, they're thinking about what's going to be practical for when you get a job. And these subjects, perhaps the correct amount of weight wasn't put on them. And with the way world is changing...
I know, exactly.
And the way that... creativity is the thing that sets us apart from what automation will be able to do.
Exactly.
It's not just, if you're doing drama at school, it's not just that you're going to grow up and be the next Benedict Cumberbatch. It's the stuff that James was saying about empathy. It was the stuff that Jez was saying about being able to think about problems creatively. That's why there needs to be a focus on these subjects. But people need educating themselves that there is a value in them.
I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it? I think that, you know, when you hear the sort of sense of magic in James's voice about what his school did for him, you know, you just think it's absolutely criminal for us to be thinking, well, those subjects are less important. I mean, it's completely mad. I mean, it just makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
You know, what, as he sort of said, you know, what we got, like, Oscars and this, that, and the other, and, you know, we're renowned around the world for our creative industries, and we're, like, downgrading them. I mean, like, where do you even start with that? I mean, that is, you know, this is like a crisis that we've lost, you know, these drama teachers and less people taking creative subjects. You know, it's like, I kind of think if it was happening in, you know, well, it probably has happened to some extent in science and other things, but you know, any country worth its salt be thinking, this is a problem, you know, we should be doing something about it. So, I mean, at that first level, you've got to get these creative subjects in. Secondly, I think there is an interesting question, which I suppose came up for me, about the extent to which we're still in this, what this head teacher said to me, the industrial age model, you know, separated learning, English, maths, history, not project-based. I think there's really... the fact that education doesn't feel that different from 100 years ago in some sense is a problem. Yeah. And then thirdly, there's a bit which I'm more mixed about, which is this accountability thing, because I can sort of I can see the problem about too much testing, definitely GCSEs and A-levels. I think, you know, the Labour government in 2004 had a chance to do the so-called baccalaureate system and didn't. The Tomlinson report, it was a report into education. I wouldn't want to take away all the accountability, or I want to replace it with proper account, you know, with different, a better system of accountability. But I mean, there's a lot that needs to change, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So much to talk about in education. If you've got thoughts, you can find us at Cheerful Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com, or you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. We've had an email sort of on the subject of education from Amma from Reading. Hi, Ed and Jeff. Firstly, love the podcast. I'm roping in as many of my conservative friends, including my parents, to give it a listen. If you could shout out Dr. Frieda and Sylvester from Surrey, they die of happiness. We've just done it. Shout out Dr. Frieda and Sylvester from Surrey.
That's a lot of responsibility if they're going to die of happiness.
Yeah, I think that's a sort of metaphor. Anyway, just listen to episode 19. As a young black woman of Ghanaian descent who's passionate about the education sector and the lack of diversity in the curriculum, I was super pumped to hear you discuss the lack of knowledge in the curriculum about the colonial era. That was in a discussion with Glenn Moore a couple of weeks back. I've always thought it odd we jump from Henry VIII to World War I and II, and then American history, JFK, etc. I feel as though a real focus could be on the gaps, such as apartheid, migration of the empire post-World War II, the empire both good and bad, and also the history of the places that were colonised. What was Ghana's political structure before colonisation? Who were the Maharaja, and what were their empires like before colonial rule? I feel as though seeing these countries as great in their own right before British rule can demonstrate to people that these countries existed before discovery and had a deep, rich culture before colonialism. Sorry, this is super ranty. So I have a question for you both. If you could both design your dream curriculum, what would you have as compulsory subjects? I would have intersectional feminism for beginners as a compulsory GCSE subject, how to identify fake news 101, but I'll probably teach how Stormzy is better than Mozart. Kidding. Everyone knows Bach was the real OG. Anyway, thanks for all you're doing, guys.
I'm really into this idea of project learning. Yeah. I was thinking about it as we were talking, and like you could do a great Beatles project, which of course is about the Beatles, but then you've got history of Irish immigration and Liverpool and the sort of
really
the industrial
point.
Revolution and technology. I mean, there's loads of things you can
really
spin off from any subject.
Point. And also imagine saying to young people, we're going to do a Beatles project where we learn all these things.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, here's some disconnected facts I want you to learn.
Yeah. So what would yours be then?
The history of the Boston Red Sox. class struggle. The more arcane rules. I'll think about you. I'll get back to you.
This comes from Perjeet, who says, Dear Ed and Jeff, my husband and I enjoy listening to the podcast. We both feel better informed and generally more cheerful afterwards. I appreciated your mini segue into empire at the end of the last podcast. I'm a British Asian. My parents are from the Indian side of Punjab and studied history up to degree level. Yet at no point was I taught or given an opportunity to learn an informed, objective history of empire. I've only recently, at the age of 33, properly read up on the negative aspects of Britain's legacy in India, mainly by reading Shashi Kapoor's Inglourious Empire. There are still huge gaps in my knowledge when it comes to Britain's relationship with the rest of the empire. I generally think Brits only have the vaguest understanding of what their ancestors got up to. But after reading Shashi Kapoor's book, I felt a loss for the country India could and might have been if it hadn't been for British intervention. I think it's a good idea. I mean, it was just a passing comment we made, really.
I know, and it's really been picked up by people. I mean, I suppose to be sort of self-critical for a second, there is a kind of tension, isn't there? Because at one level, part of our foregoing discussion about education has been about, you know, how do we make it more sort of project-based, not just learning facts and so on. And yet there's also this, we also, both of us, hanker for, you know, a sense
of
national identity.
You couldn't learn this stuff within projects.
That, correct. That's true.
Perjeet says, on a completely separate note, I'd love to hear a podcast about the growing divide in attainment for rich and poor students at school. Well, I guess, you know, we've done an education topic on this week's podcast, but we were just saying when the microphones were switched off, there's a lot more we can come back to on this.
Definitely. Next, let's talk about sortition. Chris Towner from South Bucks, UK. Okay, guys, your sortition episode is simply mind-glowingly brilliant. That's episode 20. Never before have I felt so optimistic that the future is bright and orange. No, he didn't say that. Having been struggling to believe anything could bring the country back together in a productive political direction, it feels like this could be the single most important priority for us right now. So the next question to answer is, how can we insist that methods such as sortition and informed polling can be the required approach to revive UK democracy? Do we need judicial intervention to force its implementation, or do we need to march on the streets and demand it? We need a next step. Discuss.
Well, I thought what you said last week was good, which was take the NHS and social care, for example, like a cross-party thing could be set up to do some deliberative democracy and public consultation on it in this way. And if people see it work, and if people understand how it's happening and it's not being fixed by vested interests, then they would have faith in it.
I think we need to think about the way to design it so it gets big buy-in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think if you just did it in an obscure way and then came up with an answer, people would say, well, so it's like you need a...
Well, you'd need to make a big deal out of it, you know, that we want to give power back to the people. This is how it's been.
I mean, maybe Channel 4 or something could do a, you know, for example, could do a big thing on it.
Yeah.
You know, how to... But you know, I do think it's worth thinking about. I think you should hold me to account for trying to push this forward.
Great, we'll check in on your progress.
Yeah.
This comes from Adam, who says, "Dear Ed and Jeff, I thought the episode addressing participatory democracy was the most inspiring thus far. I grew up watching enormous and possibly unhealthy quantities of Star Trek, Stargate, Star Wars, and other star-themed programming." Stars in their eyes, maybe. "Each of these excellent programs portrayed a wide variety of models of democracy for their strengths and pitfalls. The ability of our society to debate as a democracy is something I worry about regularly. Many of my liberal friends struggle to even hear the viewpoints of those on the centre-right and cannot tolerate people with different views. This really worries me for the health of our debates as a society. People with differing views are simply dismissed as the out group and ignored. As an NHS trainee therapist, cognitive behavioural therapy, it's often my job to commit to temporarily taking on the perspective of others to help them realise ways forward. Often I meet people I don't agree with, but generally everyone you encounter is nice, even Tory voters. I see participatory democracy as a route to overcoming these erroneous political party lines and to actually have a sensible discussion."
And he adds, "You guys rock."
I wasn't going to read that.
Oh, yeah, come on. Well, look, Sortition definitely got people talking, didn't it? Who knew? Right, next, prisons. That got people talking too. "Dear Ed and Jeff, as a criminal barrister, I particularly loved your recent podcast on prisons. When I listened to Nils Ullberg..." Sorry, that's...
That's Nils Urberg.
"Speak about prison policy and Sweden's prison system, I almost wept for the lost potential for offenders here in the UK. It was like being in a sweetie shop of possibility." That's what our podcast is, a sweetie shop of possibility.
Yeah, we should put that in the description.
Exactly.
Description.
So says Kathy. "As ever, it's not about how much money is invested in locking people up, but where these resources could be better spent. When I meet families of people sent to prison, they often acknowledge they will be the first to condemn offenders they read about in newspapers, but when it's their own family member, friend, they realise acutely how pointless prison is. Keep on doing those podcasts. It's one of the only things keeping me from insanity."
And then I have a couple of photographs here. They've been sent to us by Britt Arend, who says, "My granddaughter Aurora is my biggest reason to be cheerful." And then Britt has sent a couple of pictures of Aurora, who's a couple of years old, wearing a Reasons to be Cheerful t-shirt.
Aww. I mean,
she's a cherub.
Definitely.
And if you too would like to appear cherubic, get your Reasons to be Cheerful t-shirts and tote bags and hoodies and so on. And if you want any of that stuff, we've made an easy to remember link for you. It's bit.ly/cheerfulmerch.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And here to pitch ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we're joined by comedian Alice Fraser. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Hello. I'm well, thank you for coming. Am I right in thinking that you're of a legal background?
Yes, I used to be a lawyer.
Okay. Bearing in mind that a lot of what I imagine a lawyer's life looks like, I have got by osmosis from American legal programs.
LA Law.
Yeah, Boston Legal, all those things. I mean,
Ally McBeal.
Yes. I mean, would you be funny in your kind of closing statements and stuff?
No, I was only a solicitor, so I was never a barrister. But I did find out some really interesting things about working in a corporate space. Like if you're in a glass office, you can turn your back to all of the glass walls to cry, but you'll fog up the glass.
Really?
So you got to be
good,
careful.
That's a good one to bear in mind.
Yeah.
Did you ever have that experience at Absolute Radio?
Yeah, I had my little places where I could go and cry.
Without steaming it up.
Yeah. I mean, often on public transport on the way home. Yeah. It was a big favourite of mine. So you've brought in some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful.
Yes.
What's your first one?
Okay, so this is something that I think we could bring in and it would make everybody a lot happier, is instead of having an age of consent, you have sex licenses, like driving licenses. So you have to apply for your learner's permit, first couple of years, zero blood alcohol. You gotta do it. You have a supervisor in the car with you at all times. And then you get, you know, you
like
go up your level.
A sex instructor.
Yeah, but like, just to observe so that you can get your license.
Okay.
And then
but
at
do you
higher
have to,
levels.
Do you have to have lessons as well, though?
No. I think you just have to pass tests.
Right.
So you don't have to have a certain number of hours under your belt.
Right.
You just have
to
achieve.
No pun intended.
But you know how when you go in, I don't know if you do it here, but you go in for your ELS test and you have to just pass a test, basic questions.
Yeah.
I remember one very distinct one when I was doing my learner driver's test was, if you see a horse, do you A, accelerate towards the horse, B, honk at the horse to warn it, or C, drive carefully past the horse?
Where did you grow up?
In Australia.
Is it in the middle of nowhere? Is it specific to... Sounds a bit Crocodile Dundee-ish.
I mean, it is a little bit. In Sydney, where I did my driver's test, everyone does their practicing of their L plates near a park, Centennial
right.
Park, which is in the centre. They've now banned learner drivers from because it was just full of people driving very slowly into trees. But there were horses also in that park, so I think...
I think trying to neatly steer away from the sex license.
No, I'll tell you what, I just remembered, actually. Didn't you...
Let's talk about driving.
When you were a teenager, this doesn't apply to your sex life. Didn't you go on television to decry Crocodile Dundee?
No.
I'm sure you told me a story about... You used to go on a local London...
I think it was radio and it was Indiana Jones.
Okay.
Yeah, but other than that, you're bang on.
Save that.
No, I'm not being like, this is not lascivious or prurient or anything. Mm. I just think this is one of the few areas of life where you can genuinely ruin somebody's life if you don't do it properly.
Yes.
Like driving. And yet it's completely unregulated.
Yeah. Would you have to wear an L plate?
Yes.
Until you passed your test?
Yes, on your junk. I just had the image of a man at a bar sort of leaning his arm on a bar and flicking out like a license and being like, hey, baby, I'm qualified.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I think some people need it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we've learned.
I mean, if you don't need it, you don't need it. But if you need it, you really need it.
Right. Okay. All right. Ed, do you think that policy would...
Yeah, I buy it.
Yeah.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah. All right. What do you have next?
The next thing I had was a young adult swap. So there are more and more people of, like, particularly my generation who are living with their parents until, you know, their 30s in order, you know, to save money or what have you. But living with your parents until your 30s is a deeply unnatural state of affairs. You're biologically required to go off on a motorbike in your teens. So it just gets more and more tense and some people figure it out and other people don't. But I think, you know, instead of moving out and, you know, building more houses and kind of having to deal with all of those issues, you could just swap. Just swap with someone else's parents.
Because your other people's parents won't get on your nerves like your own parents will and vice versa.
And vice versa. And you'll be nicer, you'll be less, you know, sort of pushed back into the box of your own teenage rebellion.
I like that.
Yeah,
it's interesting you should say this because there is this scheme to put young people who need somewhere to stay with older people, some of whom might have... you know, mental health issues or dementia or whatever, together. And it sort of
to
started,
make sure they don't have to go into a home.
So they can stay in their home longer.
Yes.
And it seems to be quite, you know, popular.
Yeah, and I think we miss cross-generational and cross-age friendships these days. Like in school, you're kind of put at the same level as people of your same age and you don't have that sense of, like, responsibility for younger people or looking up to older people.
Yeah.
I miss that.
And you also get to feel like you're the funds in somebody else's house.
Yeah.
But don't you think it's... The only thing I say, admittedly my kids are 7 and 8, they're not moving out yet, is I think the one thing I feel is that it's quite good for the... Because empty nesting tends to be quite traumatic for the parents. And the
you're not worried about that already, are you?
No, I worry about lots of things. But the thing is that this sort of is quite good, but it's a sort of counterpoint to empty nest. So when you say to people who've got grown-up kids these days... You know, oh, are you feeling worried about being empty nest? No, because they've not moved out. You know, it's quite a nice...
Yeah, Exactly thing. That you have someone in the home.
But you really want other people's children rather than your own, I suppose.
But a lot of people feel like, you know, they're stuck in this weird hinterland between being kids and being adults because they can't afford to get on the property ladder or move out or whatever. Mm. And this would be a step towards solving that a little bit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all of the benefits of living with your parents without any of the living with your parents part.
I mean, some people are stuck between being kids and adults, even living in their own home in Stoke Newington, aren't they?
Did I ever tell you the story about when I first moved from up north to London, I used to go back at the weekends and my mum would insist that I brought my laundry with me. So I had a flat in Manchester that I kept for the first little while I lived in London. And I'd get the train from London to Manchester. My mum would stand on the platform in Macclesfield. And when the train pulled in, you know, I'd put the window down, I'd pass the laundry out the window. And then when I was coming back on a Sunday evening, she'd be standing there with it, washed and ironed.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Did you not even get out to have a cup of tea with her?
No, there was no time.
Where were you on your way to?
Yeah, I was just going to hang out with friends and things.
You know how trains work, you know? There's another one that
comes. You were coming back from London.
Yeah, so I was working in London, living in London, but I kept my flat in Manchester. So the train would go through Macclesfield. My mum would be waiting there on the platform.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she would tell me that she wanted to keep her hand in at being a parent.
Yeah.
Like it felt sad to her to have me move to London. So she felt like, you know, she was actively participating in my life by being handed dirty laundry. And then...
So you wouldn't get out, the train would carry on to Manchester.
Yeah. So then I'd carry on to Manchester. I'd go out for the weekend with friends. When I was on the way back to be back in time for work on a Monday, she'd be waiting on the platform with the washing.
And you thought that the smell of your dirty shirts was sufficient presence of her son in her life?
I think she thought that. They would also sometimes they'd come and visit me in London and she'd take the laundry back up north with her and then post it to me in a big box to work. I'd turn up at work and be
I
like,
slightly you know, wonder whether we should edit this bit out because it reflects badly on you.
I was much younger. We all made
How
mistakes
much
in our
younger?
Youth. Yeah. It's just before Last I got year. Married, yeah.
Do you not even like say I'll stop and have a cup of tea or
No, it was the last train back.
Should we move on?
Yes.
I felt it was appropriate to the idea.
Yeah.
It was some way relevant. You don't think it was relevant?
No, I think it is relevant.
We've got to be non-judgmental about him.
I've judged.
You think you've judged? I've kind of judged. Well, let's pretend to be non-judgmental. It's supposed to be a safe space, you see, this space.
Yeah, my reason to be cheerful or suggestion that would make the world better is if nobody ever does that.
Yeah, that's good. That's true. I totally endorse that idea. Don't do this at home.
Do not. I mean, you're obviously an expert operator in this system.
Yeah,
but,
I'd like to, a pioneer, I would say.
You're a qualified stuntman.
Yes. Did you, all right, since you're so keen to move on, did you have another idea?
My other idea is, it's an interesting thing just coming over to the UK because I don't think sports is as big a thing here as it is in Australia.
So how long have you been here?
I go back and forth.
Right, okay.
So this time round, I've been here since November.
Right. And you've noticed that Australians are more passionate about sports?
Just that the conversation doesn't happen here. In Australia,
and there are no sex licenses here either.
Yeah, that's
true.
Do you
have those in Australia?
No, we don't.
No, you don't, right.
But there's a lot of unlicensed sex people around. I shouldn't have said that. What I mean is that here it seems a nonsensical thing to go, what's your sport?
Yes.
What everyone in Australia, or for most people, have a sport that they played at high school or they're
What's
still
yours?
Engaged in. I did rowing and then athletics.
Oh, so not just as a spectator. So you're not just talking about spectators and being fans. You're talking about active participation.
I'm talking about active participation.
Right.
I think
Maybe
everyone...
it's a British thing of sort of not being sporty. There's quite a lot of people.
Yes, I think there's a...
Not sort of just like just not sporty in Britain.
Yes, and I think everyone should be a bit sporty.
Yeah. Or ginger. Or baby, or posh. And you just pick one and stick with it, I think.
Stick with it.
I mean, Jeff is like...
Scary.
Jeff's sport is the 3,000-metre steeplechase. But apart from that, he's not that sporty.
Well, just finding something that you like doing. I think it really is an underrated thing, having at least a slightly more serious and less comedic, but just having something that you do with your body to whatever capacity you're able. I think it makes
a big
difference.
So I've never found anything that I like doing with my body, apart from like sitting horizontally. So slumping. I really like slumping. But aside from that, I've never found a physical sporty activity that I've enjoyed. Are you sporty, though?
I'm really not.
You do your jogging, your slow jogging.
No, I don't, very rubber inanimate object.
Borderline fast walking.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I'm not sporty. But I think I think, yeah, I think it is, because also I think it makes you more cheerful, actually.
It does, and particularly for younger people, just knowing where the edges of your body are, what you're capable of, it makes you feel safer walking around.
So do you still do rowing?
No, I broke my back. But
your back?
Well, fractured it, but it's more dramatic when you say broke. On the river, I was hit by a boat, with another boat.
Oh, my God.
That was a very small fracture, but it does sound very dramatic. But then I still run a bit and I just go to the gym. But I just, it's one of those things. I think if you feel like you've
got the sense. Is it the outdoorsiness of Australia? You see, I confess that I made these New Year's resolutions, which Jeff sort of laughed at, and he was right to, about doing more exercise and so on, and I've completely failed.
But your big thing is about the weather, though, isn't it?
Well, I think it's just when it gets dark at 4 o'clock. I mean, it's just so depressing, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I sort of feel that because it's getting a little lighter a bit later, I sort of feel a bit more motivated that maybe I'll do some.
You could become a noctambulator.
You're what, sorry?
The people who walk around in the dead of night.
Really?
Yeah, that's a thing. Does that not appeal in the long, dark winter months, skulking around under the cover of darkness?
Maybe. Yep. Maybe. So how do you get over that in Britain?
I don't know. I just think you need to. I think it's one of those.
You go running at night, do you?
No, I'll go in the daytime, but then I'm in control of my own hours because I'm a comedian. But I think it's something to do. It's one of those things when you're not doing it, it seems insane. Like it's something that you couldn't possibly fit into your schedule. And when you're doing it, you think, how does not everybody do this?
20 minutes less on Twitter or...
That sounds horrendous.
Or just be on Twitter, but on a Stairmaster, you know? Feel like you're climbing towards the insults.
I think you're right about this. Yeah. You're right about this.
If people want to come and see you, I mean, you're over here for a while. You're going to be doing Edinburgh. What's the
plan? I am. I'm going to be doing Edinburgh. I'm doing the live Bugle on the 22nd of February at Leicester Square Theatre.
This is Andy Zaltzman's
podcast.
He's our finest satirist, I think.
He's brilliant and very prolific. And it's one of those great things where I was a fan for many years and then I got to be on the podcast. And it's a... Do you swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
It's a fucking delight. I really enjoy it very much. And also I'm on Twitter and doing various things in the next few weeks, but I can't remember them. So find me on Twitter.
Great. Alice Fraser, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for coming along.
Thanks so much for having me.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, here we are in the outro.
Oh, we're in the outro.
Gotten uncomfortably hot in here today.
Well, your wife said it had. Well, your wife said it was like a sort of college dorm.
Yeah, we're uncomfortable. It's like a sauna.
It's fine. I'm perfectly happy.
You're very hot blooded, though, aren't you?
I am.
Yes,
I am. I'm very hot blooded, passionate, particularly around you.
Thank you.
And you're feeling particularly hot blooded and passionate because your mother-in-law's here.
She is, and she was very excited to meet you. She came up during the recording of the
podcast. She's lovely. She's so lovely, Lynn Barron.
And she's given you presents for your sons.
She has Chicago Cubs t-shirts.
How do you feel about that as a fan of Boston teams?
I feel really good about it, actually, because the Cubs were, after the Red Sox reversed the curse and won the World Series in 2004, the Cubs were the people with the longest run of not winning the World Series, like 100 years or something. And they've just won it, I think, a year before last. So, you know, they've kind of... We like the Cubbies.
Okay, so you're happy to pass these teams. They won't be going into a skip as you leave here.
No, definitely not. And I thought she was really nice. I think you're incredibly lucky to have her as a mother-in-law. I love my mother-in-law too, but you've also got a lovely mother-in-law.
And I think you'll be seeing more of Lynn Barron because she's coming to Liverpool with us. If you're listening to this the day it's released, Monday the 19th, of February, we're going to be in Liverpool tonight. We'd love for you to come along. You can get tickets at bit.ly/cheerfulliverpool.
Definitely. And if you're listening after Monday, sorry you missed it, but you'll be hearing the live episode at some point in the next few weeks.
Thanks to our guests, James Graham, Jez Bennett and Madeline Holt, and comedian Alice Fraser. Emma Corsham produced our podcast with backup and research from Alex Feisbrice and Lindsay Todd.
James Deacon did our idents, Ed C did our music, Gail Lofthouse was our announcer, and Emily Power did our artwork.
I think that's everyone, isn't it?
Didn't you think I did that well?
Remarkably well, yeah. You weren't even working for notes.
You were quite speechless, weren't you?
Yeah, we'll...
It's only taken me 22 weeks.
We'll cover that in your appraisal.
Thank you very much. Yeah. He's been faking his school reports.
He's been showing solidarity with Nicaragua.
And these have been...
Reasons to be cheerful.
Hi. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.